No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in with a question and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. Maria, how are you?
I'm doing very well, healthy, and as are my family, so grateful. Thank you, Michael. And you guys are staying healthy, too?
Yeah, we're pretty much healthy. You know, I'm an old guy. I'm stumbling around a little bit, but I'm still kicking. And tonight, we have a very special guest, and we're very excited to have Movila with us, who most served in the Obama administration as a director of administration and senior advisor in the office of Vice President Biden, where he worked with Ron Klain, the newly appointed chief of staff to President-elect Biden. This was his second time at the White House. He was appointed to another position where he served as chief financial officer and senior advisor on Hispanic affairs for Vice President Al Gore. He holds the distinction of being the first Hispanic American and gay American to serve twice in a senior executive role in the White House. And we have him here with us tonight. And we're so excited. So excited. Mo, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's great to be with you and Maria. And by the way, I love this alliteration. We have Michael, Maria, and Mo. Hello.
Yeah, there you go. And you know what? Mo, I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and you always were nice to guys named Mo, you know, because as you said, you know, 50% of the time they were connected, if you know what I mean.
So, well, and we should mention a proud Texan, and I, Mo, I was born in Beaumont, Texas, so
oh,
I hear
were,
once
when
a,
I'm from the yeah. Valley, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Once a Texan, always a Texan.
That's right. You're a Tejana, and I'm a Tejano. That's right. Hey, Michael, I'm sorry. We cannot move forward until I do my one New Jersey joke that I have. And let me clarify,
oh,
I love the people of New Jersey. But
please,
when you said
ahead.
You were from northern New Jersey, the question then is, which exit?
exit 14. Newark.
You see, Maria, they know their exits there because everyone, that's the running joke in Jersey.
That.
They all live.
You know,
I guess, is it off the turnpike or is it off the, it's off the turnpike, right, Michael?
Yeah, it's off the turnpike, you know. Mo, people keep on, you know, since I've been a kid and moved to Washington at 12 years old, people have always said, where in North Jersey? Well, I'm not saying North Jersey. I'm saying Newark, New Jersey, you know, because that's how we say it, Newark.
Ah,
and
there you go. I heard
people
you. I
go
North Jersey too. Oh,
yeah,
so Newark.
Go,
got it.
Yeah, they'll go Newark, and I go, no, that's in Delaware. Newark is in Delaware.
Ah, very
Newark,
good.
Newark, N-U-R-K, is the biggest city in New Jersey.
There it is.
But,
it sure is in the home of Cory.
It's a great place
to be Booker.
From. Home of Cory Booker. We're proud of him.
I bet you are.
Home of many members in the Mafia Hall of Fame as well. But since you worked at the White House with the new chief of staff, Ron Klain, is am I pronouncing his name right?
You are. That's exactly right, Ron Klain.
What do you think about his style? What can you tell us about him that might give us sort of a picture of what the inner circle at the White House might look like in the future?
Well, first of all, let me say this. this is a very personal question for me. I'm actually getting a little emotional in about the answer because when I was about 32 years old, I have written a book about my 2 tenures in the White House. And in my book, I call Ron Klain my Jewish angel, because when I was 32 years old, he picked me out of a bunch of people to come and work for 6 months, Michael and Maria, in Vice President Gore's office. I was going to be borrowed, literally, on what they call on detail in the federal government from the Department of Agriculture, where I was a political appointee. And he asked me to come for 6 months and help them with a very specific project in Vice President Gore's office. And at the end of the 6 months, he walked with me to the West Wing to see Al Gore. And they together said, we'd like you to be our new CFO and our new senior advisor on Latino and LGBT affairs. Wow. As I said in my book, Ron Klain is a man who believed in me before I believed in myself. I was just coming out as a gay man, growing up Latino. Maria can understand this greatly, growing up in Texas. Being Latino, Catholic, Hispanic, that was the same thing, but redundant. Latino, Catholic, son of a very prominent family in the sense of not prominent by wealth, but prominent by public service. The odds were all against me. So Ron Klain and Al Gore believed in me, honestly, before I believed in myself. That'll tell you who he is as a human being, first and foremost. As a manager, but what you're going to see here is you're going to watch, I hope, in awe, because I was in awe both times I was his deputy. Both of my tenures were under his leadership in the White House. And so I consider him a brother. He's a dear friend, a man I admire tremendously. And let me tell you, I'll quickly run down the skills you will be watching. The greatest multitasker I've ever seen in 59 years of life, bar none.
Wow.
Brilliant. That's great. Like brilliant genius. I'm not kidding. A strategist extraordinaire. Solutions oriented. And he does it all, okay, with a humility and just this grace. I've never heard in my 7 years of working for Ron Klain as his deputy, I've never, ever one time heard him raise his voice. I've never heard him demean or diminish another person.
Wow.
Even in the toughest moments. I mean, I'm talking, we were there for the Recovery Act, right? We've been there. Right. I was with him for, you know, all kinds of times in the Clinton-Gore White House. So you can imagine subpoenas every day and, you know, all kinds of things. And then in the Obama White House with the Recovery Act, I've never seen him lose his composure. Not one time under any circumstance. That is what you're going to see as the chief of staff to the president-elect. Steady as he goes, calm, grace, humility, and brilliance. The perfect combination you want in a leader.
Yeah. And may I say, he was on Meet the Press this morning.
Yeah.
And he's eloquent and articulate.
Yes.
And not, obviously he thinks on his feet, but it was thoughtful responses that he gave. I was super impressed. That's my first experience with him, seeing him in that kind of a format. And I was like, ooh, we're in good hands.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that, Maria, because it's important, I think, for you know, I think the chief of staff plays a role that most Americans, frankly, don't quite understand, right? And I was quoted in, I don't know where it was, The Hill or something this past week when I was interviewed about Ron. I said the chief of staff, their primary role basically every day, once everything's set up in the White House, right? Once you've got your staff, your infrastructure, your operations and procedures in place, it becomes all day you're putting out fires. And I think I was quoted as saying Ron Klain will be the greatest fire chief of all time.
Well, that's saying a lot.
That's
especially
what he has
with
to do.
Talking about him multitasking extraordinary.
Yeah. Exactly. That's why I always point that one out, Maria, because honestly, if you are not a multitasker extraordinaire, you will not succeed at chief of staff, because can you imagine every policy thing going on, every press thing going on, every staffing issue, every budget issue, every congressional backlash, every, you name it, it's on his desk.
Well, you know, and now more than ever, we need a man like this, right? Thus, there are so many fires already, and we haven't even gotten into the transition really yet. And saw him too today on Meet the Press, Maria. And one of the things he said, which struck me, of course, it's obvious, but it's important that we know this right off the bat, is that the American people have voted the way they voted so closely together. They want us to bring the divided country together. That, he said, was one of the things that was the biggest takeaway for him mm-hmm. from the election. So any ideas how we're going to do this, Mo, when we've got, you know, 50% voting
ideas,
for
actually.
One guy and 48% for the other?
Yeah, I appreciate the question because I think that a couple of things. Let me just say one more thing about Ron Klain on particular topic, right? How does Ron play a role in that? This is one of the beautiful things about Ron Klain, frankly. As you can tell, I am an enormous fan. I really got choked up when I started answering because I love him and I respect him and I admire him. And it is a goodness that he has in his heart. And I'll tell you something. He's not petty. He never has been. He's not overly partisan either. He's a proud Democrat. Don't get me wrong. But he doesn't put partisanship ever. I've never, ever been in a meeting with him where it's about party or politics over what's best for people. And so that brings me great comfort. He will make an enormous contribution toward bridging this divide that we're speaking of. Let's talk about Joe Biden and that divide. Here's what I feel so confidently about. Obviously, having been a senior advisor to Joe Biden, worked for him, and then becoming personal friends, I have to tell you, both personally and professionally, and I can say this with tremendous confidence, there's just no other person I know right now. Let me take a step back. I don't know if either of you ever go through this, but if you're religious or you're spiritual, whether it's God, Jesus, Allah, Buddha, the trees, the universe, energy, the stars, whatever it is that you believe, right, is in control, this omnipotent power that might be in control, whatever your beliefs are, you cannot help but realize that Joe Biden, in the 77, almost 78 years of his life, was being prepared for this particular inflection point in American history. So how do we deal with the divide? First was, he happens to be the only person I know that could even begin to heal the divide. Does that mean he can do it overnight? No. Is there a miraculous miracle wand he can wave and it'll be over with in 3 months and we'll all hold hands and sing kumbaya? No. Ain't going to happen, as we say in Texas, Maria, right? Ain't going to happen. But what
Texas.
He can do, Michael and Maria, and what I expect that he will do, because it's who he is. It genuinely, authentically, sincerely is who Joe Biden is as a human being. He will, through policy, through action, through word, through gesture, he already has begun. If you watch him carefully, he's already begun extending that hand. Now, people don't want to grasp his hand. That's up to them. But it's not Joe Biden's style to pull the hand back. He will continue to offer it, again, through word, through policy, through program, through alliances, through strategic partnerships, through gestures, through actions. Everything they do will have to be demonstrative that we are saying, we may not have agreed, we may not have voted alike, but can we not go back to the fundamental premise that what really binds us all is, one, our shared humanity, two, our shared vulnerability, and three, our love of this country. And if anybody can set that tone, it's Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. I promise you, if anybody can do it. Will he succeed at doing it? I fervently hope so.
Mo, you missed out, too, about his skills that I firmly believe he possesses to help us have a leader with this pandemic. Because presently, we're like children running around with nobody taking care of us.
Horrible.
You know, parents who left the house and said, figure it out, how to turn on the stove, get dressed, do your laundry, get to school. We need somebody to help us. We're not figuring this out. And
well,
I
it's
can
leadership,
see
buddy, all right?
Yes.
It's leadership. And it's, you know, it's taking responsibility.
Yes.
And I've been saying for a long while, you can say whatever, you know, for those people who voted for Mr. Trump and they love him, they have that right to do that. I don't denounce them or I don't criticize or judge them for that. What I do say, though, is always remember, I go back to what my mom and dad taught me in my little Latino household in South Texas on the Mexican border, right? And they always taught us growing up the antithesis of Mr. Trump's behavior, literally. Literally, the antithesis of Mr. Trump's behavior. Maria, you raise his current behavior. Not one iota of an effort to try to save lives these next 70 days from this pandemic that is disproportionately, I might add, taking black and brown lives.
Mm-hmm.
Not one iota of an effort. Instead, he goes golfing. That's the antithesis of what our parents taught us, is it not?
Yes.
Right. It really is. And, you know, now, Mo, you've invoked a story in me. I supported him. I was a super delegate for him, and I supported him from day one because I worked on his campaign briefly in 2008. And although, you know, he had this very brief campaign for during the primary. And although I didn't get to know him, I got to know a lot of his people. And his people were wonderful. He surrounds himself with wonderful people. And and that's exactly what I thought. We needed a healer and he's the guy to do it. But
you
let
know,
me ask you, since you were in charge of Latinos, what happened to the Democratic Party and Latinos?
Well,
Trump won in Florida and Texas with the Latino vote, which I think we assumed was our vote as Democrats.
Well, there's your first answer to your question right there. You shouldn't. You know what happens when we assume.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not going to say it on air, right? But
you can.
We all know what happens when
you
assume. Okay. So the Democratic Party, for far too long, and I'm going to be. Everyone who knows me will tell you I have no filter. And I tell the truth.
That's right.
If it means that somebody sends me hate mail when I'm on Maria Bartiromo every 10 days on Fox Business, I get more hate mail. So I'm used to it. Go right ahead. But if the truth bothers you, I'm so sorry. Because let me tell you, the truth to me is what literally is should be our moral compass at all times. At all times. And if it means you alienate somebody, so be it. So I'm going to tell the truth. The truth of the matter is, that there are many people to blame for, to answer your question, Michael, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One, yes, I think the Democratic Party for far too long has taken the Latino community for granted. They just, quote-unquote, assumed, as you just said, that they were going to vote Democratic. Here's the reality, and here's what you saw. Two things, in my humble opinion. One, Donald Trump doesn't do anything well except one thing, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion. He does one thing extremely well. He is a marketing genius. And as part of that marketing genius, he has the ability to brand and define his opponents. Go back to when he first ran in 2016 with the Republican field so large. Every one of them had a name.
Yep.
Right.
He defines them. He brands them and he defines them and he repeats it just as if you were seeing a commercial on television over and over and over until it sticks.
Mm-hmm.
So what did he do here? Since way before Joe Biden's campaign was paying attention to the Hispanics in Florida, okay, he was already down there telling them that Joe Biden was a what? An S word.
Right. Socialist.
He was a socialist. Right. And here's the reality, that I couldn't tell the difference between Mike Pence, Donald Trump, and Fidel Castro, and Hugo Chavez, and Maduro. But nobody countered the narrative. So he painted this image of Joe Biden and the Democrat, not just Joe Biden, the Democratic Party. And he said the S word and the S word and the S word and the S word in every platform, social media, advertising, in-person rallies, every surrogate he had. What were we? Socialists. What were we? Socialists, right? So that's what happened in Florida. What happened in Texas, Arizona, and I don't know the numbers in California, Maria. You'd have to enlighten me. But in Texas and Arizona, it looked like we did so well in Arizona. The fact of the matter is, I'm told we actually just improved 2 points or so over the Hispanic vote for Hillary in 2016. And I believe Donald Trump actually improved somewhere between 4 and 5 points over his 26 Hispanic performance in Arizona. So the point is, we didn't do well in either of them from a Hispanic perspective. And listen, the border area is my home area. We've never had this happen. And Maria, as a Republican Latina, I think you can back me up on this. It finally caught up that the social issues that Latinos tend to be actually socially quite conservative. And it was only a matter of time, in my humble opinion, that the right candidate would connect those social conservative issues to our community, and it would take flight. And in my opinion, that is what you saw in Texas and Arizona, was a lot of Latino Catholics, that the pro-choice issue, the pro-life issue, this safety issue, you know, the jobs message of the economy. These issues just resonated, and it was a matter of time, and there was no counter narrative. That's my observation and opinion.
Let me just follow up for a second, Maria. Is part of the problem also, Mo, that we treat Latino and the Hispanic community as a monolith, that we really don't see, you know, we the Democratic Party, I've heard this criticism made, treats Latinos as if they're all the same, no matter where they come from?
Well, I think we've come a long way. I don't want to completely bash my colleagues, because I have seen tremendous improvement, Michael, okay, over the last 10 years on the Democratic side, where we're not treating the Latinos as monolithically as we used to, right? But just, again, watch what we just said. Florida, what was the message? It was different to the Cuban-American and the Venezuelan-American than it was to the Mexican-American in the Southwest.
Right.
So it proves that if you're going to talk to us in a monolithic way, you're going to get that negative, unfortunate response, right? We're not going to really be, it's not going to resonate with us. But when you talk to us in with our nuances, with our idiosyncrasies, with our specific cultural traditions in our region, in our culture, again, we may all speak Spanish, to your point, Michael, right? As I often say, Maria and I eat different tamales than my brothers and sisters from Central America. Right?
Yeah. Well, and
theirs are elote masa. Ours are like masa.
and my family is from Spain, so we don't identify
more different. So yeah, there's the Latino paella now.
Yeah. And that's why we call ourselves Hispanic. But to your point about the S word, because both of my parents speak English as their second language, I consider that I was raised in an immigrant culture, and they would rebel against anything that smells of a dictatorship or, you know, equality for all, or what, right? Because that's the reason they came here, right? Was to have rugged independence. And I think that also is an answer a little bit, Michael, to your question about the S word. Because it doesn't mean, I think, it doesn't mean the same thing to most Americans as it might mean to Hispanic Americans.
That's a really great point, actually. I couldn't agree with you more, Maria, because you're so right. That's a whole different fear factor. Really, yes. And that's what he did. It's a fear factor.
Correct. And right. And as you said, his narrative didn't get countered. And so that,
never,
if you want to call it fake news, was accepted as the truth.
Yep. That's true. It stuck. It stuck. It resonated. Yeah. And it stuck. And again, this is what he does so well. I mean, this is, hopefully this is his last gig, you know, to be able to do that. But, you know, chances are he's going to go out and do some type of media presence, you know, either own his own media company or whatever. And you're going to keep, that's continue to see him doing that, because it works for him, right? He's good at it. He's good at it. We should just learn from him on how to do that too.
How to do it better. Well, we had a guest on the program who is an advisor for leadership for almost 40 years. Also a Latino. He came from, was it Brazil, Michael? Do you remember?
Yeah, Brazil, I believe.
Brazil,
yes.
And he said he identified 12 patterns of speech that dictators have successfully used, and Trump uses all 12.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
doesn't surprise me, but it's still sobering, right? It doesn't,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, it doesn't shock me, but it's sobering. And I can only imagine, I would love to learn what those 12 are, because it is, I think that what's bothered me the most about this election, as much as I'm so ecstatic that my dear friend Joe Biden and my former boss has won this election, and that, you know, Ron Klain and these people I love, truly love and respect, are going to be in leadership roles for our nation, all of that feels so good and so exciting and relieving. But I still think that as Americans, we have to recognize that there were 72 million people who voted for Donald Trump.
Correct.
And that is, that's our reality. And
so let's go. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, given that 72 million people, let's go back to something you said earlier about him being a brilliant marketer. We hear the Republicans out there talking about him like he's a petulant child. Like, Donald Trump, you have to let President Trump come around to this. You know, yesterday he said if he won or something, which is half a concession. I don't know. But is he really a petulant child? Or is he a brilliant marketer? Does he understand that he's going to be head of the Republican Party? So he wants to keep the base fired up so that he'll have something to work with. What do you think about that?
I think he's both. I absolutely think he's both. And I actually have been calling him a petulant child for the last couple of weeks. In the media. But I have to tell you something. The more I thought about it, a couple of days, I started realizing something really sad, frankly, and disturbing. I have come to the conclusion that his behavior, it's not normal. It's not healthy. It's not healthy or normal behavior.
Not
from an adult, okay? Because I go back again to my mamacita que me enseñó, ¿verdad? Who she taught me when I was a little boy, and daddy taught me, right? Like, you can tell a lot more about a person, mom and dad used to say, when you lose that football game you were playing in than when you win.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because they would tell us, remember, I'm sure you guys were taught the same thing. When you win with humility, right? That you don't go and gloat. You don't go run into your opponent's face and go, I beat you, you know. And then when you lose, you go over and you shake the winner's hand. Remember that lesson from our parents?
Yep.
To me, I've come to this conclusion that he's it's not even a petulant child. It's a mentally unhealthy human being.
Well, you know, Mo, to that end, I was thinking this morning when he had this barrage of tweets that were all over the map about they thought maybe one was a concession and then it was like, no. And I've been trained as a psychologist and a therapist, and I came up, and you're not supposed to diagnose anybody that you haven't been in the presence of. But I believe he suffers from bipolar disorder as well as narcissism, because his swings, he goes into mania. I think they said there's been hundreds of texts just this weekend. I mean, a sane, well person doesn't do that. That's not what, quote, I mean, and none of us is normal. I don't consider myself normal.
I almost feel badly that I said anything, because you're obviously an expert and a professional. I am not. You know, so I'm just a naive observer, but I appreciate you affirming that, and I know you're not diagnosing, right? But I'm just saying, these are observations, and it's good to hear a professional and expert affirming that observation, because I have to tell you, look, I feel like in life, take it from somebody who had to overcome a lot of obstacles that almost caused me to end my life at the age of 17 when my fellow football players in South Texas turned on me when I realized the juxtaposition of the locker room, knowing I was gay. I couldn't be who I was. I couldn't express it. I couldn't live it. I couldn't say it. And then the locker room became a juxtaposition that I could not survive any longer. So when I switched and quit sports, the football players turned on me. And every day they would call me a fag and a joto for 6 months of my life between every one of my classes. And I almost took my life at 17. Somehow I knew, somehow I knew that I needed to stay here, right? That I had a survivor mentality somehow. Thank God, thank Allah, thank whoever. Mm-hmm. But somehow I had that survivor. Anyway, my point is we all of us, every single human being suffers from some hurt and pain on their journey of life, sometimes in our childhood, sometimes in our adulthood. But if you don't properly heal, am I correct, Maria? If you don't heal, that demon remains in you, and that hurt becomes a demonic expression through our behavior later in life. That is what I think you're seeing in Donald Trump, okay?
His niece came out with that, with her book, Mary Trump. And she, too, was a psychologist. And, she's filled with all of that. The little boy who got hurt, who wasn't loved properly by the mother, and all those inner child issues, et cetera. Yep. You're absolutely right. And thank goodness that you're here for us, because your story is really inspirational. And I'm glad you're sharing it, because I know the courage that it takes. But other people don't know that someone as successful as you are, which I did want to mention some of your awards that were as recently within your community, top 100 most influential people for Hispanics in the nation's capital, top 100 Hispanics in America. I mean, top 101 Latino leaders. People wouldn't know, because on the outside with your success and a law degree, and your father and your uncle were both judges, and your cousin is a U.S. Congress member. I mean, you've got success all over you. People wouldn't know that you were struggling.
Well, you're so sweet to say all of that, and you actually made me cry a little bit, and I have to tell you something. I really believe what I just said a minute ago. It doesn't matter what anybody's title is. It doesn't matter what success they've achieved. It doesn't matter how much money they have, the color of their skin, nothing. None of that matters, because at the end of the day, we are all human beings who have all struggled, succeeded, laughed and cried, feared and hoped, dreamed and aspired. We all of us are equal that way. And so I appreciate what you're saying, not so much about me, but for that kid in Anacostia, or that kid on the east side of L.A., who right now, for whatever reason, is sitting there wondering whether they even have a future, right? Whether it's for personal reasons, or whether it's socioeconomic challenges, or whether they lack the access and opportunities that some of us have been so blessed to have. But we've got to tell our stories, every single one of us. I encourage every one of your listeners, please tell your stories. Every single human story, we can all learn something from it. Every single one of them.
Well, even you know,
right?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mo.
No. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm going on and on.
I was just gonna say, you know, that's certainly something that I see as a big difference between Trump and Biden is that Trump has exploited the hurt that you talk about, whereas Biden has used his own personal hurt.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of personal hurt there to, share and make things better for the people around him.
Michael, you know, to that point, I don't want to breach my private conversations with the Biden family, because they're, you know, many of them are personal and private conversations that are sacred, and I cherish that. But I will say this. I have had these conversations with Joe Biden himself on this these concepts of that we have to address our hurt and our loss, whatever that may be. With him, it was losing, as you mentioned, his wife and his young daughter, and then his son later. You know, for me, it was what I just shared about when I, in my youth, and trying to come to live with my truth and my authenticity, right? And it doesn't matter what it is, but I've had those conversations with him, and you're spot on. That is what makes him so special and so beautiful as a human being, because he's so secure in his skin that he can be vulnerable. And I think that those people who are allow themselves to be vulnerable, that's when people can connect with you. That's when people can relate to you. That's when that shared humanity becomes a bond. And that bond can become impenetrable, right? It can become impenetrable, and you can do wondrous things together in that, with that bond, once you recognize that you're equal and that you share that humanity, that vulnerability, that volatility, right? As two people. Yep. And he possesses that gift, and it is a gift. It is a gift, and he possesses that gift. It is so wonderful. Can I share one story now that we're on such a heartfelt, you know, path here? That I this is one of the. There's only two personal stories I share about the Bidens, and one of them seems extremely appropriate right now, because it really proves what we're saying here about him as a person. Okay, and let's not mess around with this. The reality is, we do lead based on who we are as a human. We lead based on who we are as a person. Okay, you don't separate the two, right? If you're mean and evil and divisive and hateful, that's the way you will lead. If you're a loving, compassionate, empathetic, humble person, you're going to lead that way. So I was his director of management and senior advisor for the first 18 months of his vice presidency. And when I left, it was very sad for me to leave, but I had taken a 72% cut in pay, literally, to come leave my real estate company to come serve again. And I took a 72% cut in pay. I couldn't afford to stay any longer, basically. So I left. And I stayed in touch with the Bidens, and we had become very good friends. And lo and behold, a few years later, he and his sister Valerie went and had an audience with Pope Francis. And out of the clear blue sky, this is 3 years after I finished working for them, I get a call from the vice president's residence saying, you need to come by the vice president's house. I said, of course, I mean, who says no? I'm not coming by. I got in a car. I drove over there to the Naval Observatory, and they, allowed me through the Secret Service. I go in, and the vice president's sister, Valerie, said, Joe wants you to have something we brought you. And he only had 5 to 10 rosaries blessed by the Pope.
Mm. Wow.
And he brought me back one of them. Mm. And wow. it wasn't just a spiritual powerful moment for me. It was that one moment where I realized, gosh, this man and the Biden family, they're just special people. They know how to love. They genuinely care. He didn't have to do that. I hadn't worked for him in 3 years.
Yeah.
He didn't have to do that.
Well, obviously, he remembered you and thought of you in that way. Because as a practicing Roman Catholic myself, having been to Rome and the Vatican and all of that, I've never had an audience with the Pope. I haven't had a rosary. I must have 25 rosaries around. And to have one blessed by Pope Francis.
You know why I have tears in my eyes and telling the story.
Well, you brought it to me, too.
It's to me, I even have it in my will that I want to be buried with that rosary. Because it means so much to me on so many fronts. Not just the spirituality of it, not the Pope, just the Pope Francis aspect of it, but the Joe Biden and Valerie Biden Owens aspect of it. The love, the friendship, the reality of our bond. Do you know what I'm saying? The gesture. The gesture. So anyway, tells you who he is. It just tells you who he is. That's who's about to be our president. And That just brings me so much comfort, and I hope it brings your listeners an equal level of comfort to know that beautiful soul is about to lead our country, and that gives me hope. That gives me hope.
Well, now, Mo, you've invoked in me that I have to tell my one favorite Biden story, my one interaction, and I hope I don't cry. I worked on his 2008 campaign, so I was invited to a book signing that he did, and I had just been elected, and I got on the elevator to go up to the roof where this event was, and this handsome young man got on the elevator with me, and I introduced myself, and he said, "Hi, I'm Bo Biden."
Oh.
Well, I immediately knew who he was, and he knew who I was when I introduced myself, that I was a senator that didn't get to vote, that wasn't recognized by Congress. And we got up to the roof, and I was like a duck out of water. I was brand new in the office, and all these senators and congressmen were up there. I didn't know any of them. And the entire night, every time Bo Biden saw me standing there with a cocktail by myself, he would grab me and take me over to somebody from Washington, D.C. and say, "This is Michael Brown," like Anne Hand. He said, "This is Michael Brown. He's your senator. You should know him. This is my," and it was so kind of him to even notice me, let alone go out of his way. And I'm the parent of three children. And let me tell you something. You can't raise a person like that unless you're a decent
unless
person.
You are like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Michael, that's
a
beautiful story. I'm so glad you shared that because Bo was just such a special man and a special human being. And that is such a beautiful story about Bo. In fact, I hope to see the Biden soon. And when I do, I'm going to share that if that's okay with you. Because
please do that.
That is something the Bidens would want to hear. It really is.
Well,
that's an example.
We were in Iowa. My daughter and I were in Iowa for the caucuses, and Mrs. Biden came to an event, and I got to sit down and tell her that. But
But
she looked like a zombie at that point. You know what I mean? They were all, you know how this works, Mo. They probably had been in Iowa for a week and had like 2 hours sleep because they were at everything, you know. So I'm not sure it registered. But she, too, was just as gracious as she could be. She took pictures
of
my daughter.
You know what the moral of that story is, in addition to what
please.
You just said, Michael? Because you're so right. You said something so powerful. An offspring will not possess those traits and characteristics unless the parent does, most likely. And that's a very powerful thing. The second moral of the story, in my opinion, is it's another great example of who the Bidens are as human beings. And it's really simple. They see you.
Yes.
They see
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
He saw you. Do you know what I'm saying? Like he saw Michael Brown. He saw Michael, the person.
Right.
And he felt and sensed that you were a fish out of water. He had that intuition. Right. That's called grace. That's called empathy. Mm-hmm. That's called goodness and kindness, right? When you say, you know what? That man shouldn't feel out of. Let me make sure he feels welcomed and comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right, and it goes right back to something that you said, Mo, about feeling a responsibility. You know, a great leader, I believe, feels that responsibility of leadership to reach out to those people around it, because great leaders don't change the world. They get the people around them to change the world. And so I think that's, I think that's a very, very important quality.
You can bank on this. Right now, Joe and Jill Biden, you can bank on it. They're worried sick that people are dying and being infected at these uncontrollable rates. I assure you they are worried sick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I can't even fathom the frustration that he must feel right now with his hands being tied by the incumbent president. I can't even begin to imagine what that must feel like when you realize I can actually make a difference and be part of the solution and do something about this. But they're blocking.
I'm being denied
me. They won't
access.
Let me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Mo, I just wanted to tag back to what we were saying earlier about those 12 statements. Our guest was Helio Fred Garcia, and the book is called Words on Fire, The Power of Incendiary Language and How to Confront It, Ooh. Just as an FYI. So that
Words.
Was, but I, Words on Fire.
Words
and it's
on
got
fire.
A picture
okay.
of President Trump from the back. It shows
wow.
the back of his head. But I would like you, if you don't mind, since we still have some time, to share with our listeners about the Vela Group and what it is that you do.
Oh, you're so sweet. Well, you know, basically what we do is we're a consulting firm. We're a boutique consulting firm. I have the Vela Group, and then I have Movela LLC, my sole proprietorship. Both of them, they both conduct a little bit different business. The Vela Group is a group of affiliates that work with me. And we do business development consulting. I say we're in the relationship business. That's what I tell people. So when small businesses, Latino-owned businesses, African-American-owned businesses, women-owned businesses have a special place in my heart, veteran-owned businesses. So mostly a lot of disenfranchised, marginalized business owners who are small or medium, but they're in growth mode. And Maria, what we do is basically we say, you know what? Let us help you. Let us introduce you to specific targets that you, if you want to get into the airline industry, the real estate industry, the oil and gas industry, the energy sector. And we use our networks around the country and around the world to help our clients get in front of potential clients and customers and contracts, public sector, private sector, local, state, and federal. So that's in a nutshell what we do. And I'm very blessed right now to also sit on the board of directors, I think, as you mentioned in your intro, of a company called Transparent Business. That's really fascinating, Maria, because we own a software that actually manages and coordinates remote workforces. Can you imagine? So, and we Whoa. Have a Latina co-founder.
Huh.
A Latina co-founder. Yeah, she's president of the company, Silvina Moschini. And our software, in a non-invasive way, right now, it's now, can you imagine, stratospherically in demand, because we actually can help make this remote workforce that we involuntarily were forced into, we've now turned it into a positive, and it works. And we can hold employees transparent and accountable, but not in a way where we're like watching you on a camera all day, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in a very non-invasive and very autonomous and respectful way, but it gives managers and companies the chance to breathe a little sigh of relief. Dispersed workforce, don't panic, right? We've got technology between video conferencing, Slack, and those type of softwares, and then softwares mm-hmm. like ours, We've now made it to where, you know what, you can breathe easy and it works, and we can make remote work for something that'll work for everybody in the future.
And thus, so, Mr. Transparency, right?
Thus, Mr. Transparency. That's exactly right. I've had the privilege of becoming the face and the voice of Transparent Business in the media here in the United States, and so I do a lot of local stations, right, on. Five tips on this and five tips on that, right? Five tips on how to work remotely, five tips for managers, right? Five tips for how to be a good parent and a good employee at the same time during the pandemic in a remote setting, these kinds of things, right? And
yes.
So it's been an amazing, amazing experience for me to be able to share some of those insights and some of the research that I've done and we've done as a company with people to make their lives a little better and hopefully improve their lives and make this work for everybody, because I don't know if you guys even realize this, but as we've been forced to become a remote workforce, a lot of people don't realize one of the benefits is single moms who couldn't enter the workforce now get
yeah.
to, right? People with yeah. physical disabilities who couldn't physically get to the office, now they get to enter the workforce. And people who couldn't afford socioeconomically, couldn't afford the train or the bus or the car or the gas, now they get to enter the workforce. There are a lot of amazing benefits from a remote workforce. And those are my favorites right there, because as you know, you can tell probably I'm very passionate about making sure we give a voice to the voiceless.
And focusing on the positive, as you just did.
Thank you for saying that, because that's something I say, honestly, Maria. You know, there was a Reed Hastings, I don't want to bash Reed Hastings on your podcast, but Reed Hastings is the CEO of Netflix, and about a month ago, he very publicly was on a rampage saying that there's nothing good that can come from a remote workforce. And I think the Wall Street Journal or Inc. magazine or somebody called me the next day, and I went after him because I was like, Mr. Hastings, with all due respect, you're so wrong, right? But we can't be innovative and creative. I said, really? You need to spend $22,000 to fly to Hong Kong to be in a room with somebody to create a commercial or a new movie?
Yeah.
Then you're not hiring the right creativity. You're not hiring the right people. I don't need to fly to Hong Kong to be with you. I bet you and I, Maria, could get on a call tomorrow, you being a Republican, me being a Democrat, and I bet you and I could come up with an entire plan on anything we set our minds to on a Zoom call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, now that we know Movila a little bit, let's address the 800-pound gorilla in the room. What do we need to do, Mo, to get you to take a 72% cut in salary and go back to the White House?
Now,
and help
Michael,
us.
Now that,
we need
that
help.
That question's off limit. No, I'm just kidding. Listen, first of all, I would not be presumptuous enough or arrogant enough or egomaniac enough to think that I would be invited back in, number one. Number two, I have a really – I hope that this will resonate with Maria and you too, Michael, really, because there comes a time – I just turned 59 about, 3 weeks ago, and – there comes a time where you have this, I've had this epiphany where I'm like, as much as I would love to go back in a third time, it's time to pass the torch.
You're acting like you're old. You've got wisdom. We need that.
But you
know, Maria, we can impart that experience in so many different ways. And look, the Bidens will have my undying support, and Ron Klain and all of my friends that will be in all of these positions of leadership across the federal government come January the 20th. They will have my undying support. I will be rooting for them. I will be sending them positive energy and a lot of love. And they can call on me at any time if I can be helpful. But I really think it's important that some new Latinos and some new LGBT folks and some new young people and millennials and Gen Zs of any color, of any orientation, of any gender, I just think it's important. Somebody, remember, Ron Klain at 32 gave me the chance of a lifetime. I feel like I need to be now somebody else's Ron Klain. And the only way I can do that is by getting out of the way and passing the torch. Because what if Ron hadn't done that for me? I wouldn't be on this phone call with you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just...
Obviously, you don't have an ego, Mo.
Maria, look, I think we all have an ego, right? But my mom's 87. She's still alive. I am absolutely
convinced. My mom's 87.
Is she? Yeah, so you might be able to... You're going to relate to this. She may be 87, and I may be 59. But I am absolutely certain that she would get on a plane in the middle of a COVID crisis with a chancla. Do you know what a chancla is, Maria? Michael, a chancla is the sandal that a Latina mom wears that they take off and spank your butt with if you misbehave. Okay? That's a Latina chancla, is that sandal. And I am convinced at 87, if I ever acted anything but humble, my mother would be on the next plane to the Northeast and spank me with a chancla. I am absolutely certain of it. At 87, she would still do that. So I'm not about to do that to my mom.
Su hijito querido.
Exactly.
You know what? Believe it or not, we've run out of time, Mo.
I was so afraid that I wasn't going to have enough to say.
I still have like 10,000 questions I want to ask you. So I hope
if you ever run out of gas and you have like you're really in a bind and you need a backup plan, you know you can call on me. How's that?
But yes, sweet.
Well,
I'm your plan C.
Mo, I don't know why, but I have this overwhelming feeling that I want to take you out and have a drink with you.
Well,
and sit on a bar
I'd enjoy that with both of you. I really would, and I would absolutely engage in a drink with both of you. And Maria, when I'm in LA the next time, which I'm out there a lot as soon as this pandemic slows all the time, and when it slows down, I would love to go have lunch with you on the east side.
That would be great.
One of my little holes in the wall that I love over there. And Michael, I'm going to be in D.C. a lot, as you can imagine, starting soon. Yeah. And I hope that we get to break bread and continue these conversations. But if you ever literally have a you're in a bind, just call, and I'd love to come back and be with you again. And
thank you so much, Mike. You're so gracious.
Yes, you are so gracious.
Oh,
and we're so lucky to have you. And, you know,
my gosh.
We dedicate a song to people. That's how we close our show every week. And this week we're doing my favorite campaign song, which was written by Huey P. Long, a scoundrel from Louisiana who had the heart of a lion and just wrote a great campaign song. So this is for Mo. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Wait, one thing. We usually ask our guests to share your website, Mo, so people can find you.
Sure. It's there's two of them. You can do www.thevelagroup.com or www.movela.com.
Perfect. Thank you.
And on Twitter, I'm at Movela on Twitter, Moevela.
Perfect.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll look for you. Thank you
Thank
so
you
much.
Thank you so much to both of you. Abrazos.
Adios. Con Dios.
Thanks, America. We'll see you next week. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.